Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 1973, when the American Psychological Association said that homosexuality was no longer a mental illness, a non-denominational Christian group called Love in Action denounced that move and started its own treatment center. They promised to cure people of homosexuality. Three decades later, in 2004, a 19-year-old Garrett Conley entered one of these LIA programs. Today, he's telling his story. It's part of his memoir, Boy Erased. A note to our audience, Garrett's memoir includes some really difficult and sensitive issues that he's had to deal with, including sexual assault and rape. Garrett is speaking this Sunday at noon at Printers Row Lit Fest in Chicago, and he joins us now from Chicago. Garrett, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. You know, you grew up in a small town in Arkansas, and there's a scene at the end of the book where you describe your childhood, kind of how you used to play inside of cotton that was part of your family's cotton gin. I wondered if you could share that story for our audience and describe it a little bit more for us.
In a really small town in Arkansas, there were only a few things you could really do. And so sometimes I would just go out. There were these things called cotton modules, which were big stacks of cotton before it was cleaned. And so sometimes I would go out and I would sort of hollow out some of the cotton and make a little nest for myself and just sort of stare out from the cotton into the fields. And it was really relaxing. And so, you know, one of the things that my father could never understand was why I would want to be alone in one of those cotton modules. It was just kind of this pastoral life for a while growing up around that area.
Right. I wonder when you first realized you were gay and if you even had a moment of that, because it seems like from reading the memoir, a lot of it, you because of the growing up in a really in the Christian environment that you grew up in, I wonder how much of that was even acknowledged that you had inside, if you even acknowledged that inside your head.
Well, I think there were two competing narratives that were occurring as I was growing up. And one was that there was this history of faith where if you just believed that God could cure you or save you from whatever you felt, then everything would work out. So that was one narrative. And then the other narrative was that I knew that I had these strong feelings for other men. And so, you know, they were sort of always in competition with each other and they existed alongside each other.
Well, and there's one scene in the book where you realize your girlfriend's little brother is also gay. And you both have this moment where you both kind of realize that, although it's not necessarily talked about. Did you have a lot of other moments like that when you were in, I imagine from when you were in junior high or high school, where you maybe saw other people and both of you realized you were gay, but you couldn't discuss it?
I did. I actually had a really close friend growing up, and he was very feminine, effeminate, and I didn't really treat him nicely because I was so terrified of what he represented. We would always sing like Shania Twain songs together, and he would sometimes dress up in his mother's clothes, and of course I knew that that was so wrong, but I also really enjoyed it, and I think that as I grew older and as my feelings grew stronger, I became much more terrified of what that kind of life could mean for me. And so I would always avoid those other boys at all other costs.
And then you go away to college, and in your freshman year, you were raped by your friend that you had feelings for. And he's the one who actually calls your family and says you're gay. And first, I just want to say this is so awful, and I'm so sorry that you had to go through this. And I also just thought about how horrible it must have been because you were already struggling with so much guilt. As you said, you were so terrified. And I wonder at the time how much you conflated guilt over this assault with being gay.
Well, I grew up hearing only a few stories about homosexuality. One was that if I grew up to be gay, I would either be a pedophile or I would end up dying of AIDS. And those were the two big narratives that existed for me at the time. And so when I was raped by someone who had also raped a younger boy, I believed in many ways that this was a punishment from God, and that I believed that I might turn out to be like him if I continued on that path. And so when he called my parents and when my parents gave me the ultimatum that I would either attend the ex-gay facility or I would risk losing my family, I believed in many ways that this was the only choice, that I didn't want to be a pedophile. I didn't want to die. I didn't want to be separated from my family for all of eternity. And so it seemed very logical to me in the world that I grew up in.
Well, and Garrett, that first week you spend in the program, in this ex-gay therapy program, it's actually the same time your dad is finishing his ordination as a missionary Baptist preacher. And then you have that pressure on you too. And I wonder how much of your entrance in the program was related not just to what you just said, but also to the whole notion of your family and your father and his career and how your sexuality would affect that.
Yes, he became a pastor when I was 16. Well, he agreed to go through the process of becoming a pastor when I was 16, and he didn't become a full pastor until I was 19. And so that took place in the week between Love and Actions treatment. So I had 1 week of treatment, and then I went to my father's ordination ceremony. And so, in many ways, this was sort of a last-ditch effort to make sure that my father would have a straight acting son, at least, and because we would have to stand in front of a large crowd that had gathered to watch my father take his vows, and there was a lot of scrutiny at the time about who I was, who my mother was, whether or not we were a fit family for the church.
And then when your father is being ordained, you write about the moment when the pastor asks your father, there's sort of questions that pastors always get asked. And the one question that your father gets asked is, will you do everything you can to fight against the sin of homosexuality in the church? And I wonder if you could take us back to that moment, because it sort of seems like that was a turning point for you in terms of just how you sort of saw yourself, and you saw yourself in relation to the church and your father and your life.
It was a very complicated moment because I remember when my father said yes to that question, I thought, you're leaving so much out. he obviously believed that he needed to fight against the quote unquote sin of homosexuality in the church. But he was beginning to have his own complicated journey as to what that would consist of. And I don't think he knew at that point whether or not, if the treatment failed, if he would continue to, give me this ultimatum about you'll never see your mother again, you'll never see your family again. And so I think that in that moment when I saw him act with pure conviction, I began to see that this, in many ways, this was a lie, and that we needed to complicate the narrative in some way. But I didn't know how to go about doing that. I mean, it was a very confusing moment, and I always hated being in the spotlight in that way, because I felt so scrutinized as a kid growing up underneath my dad.
I'm speaking with Garrett Conley. He's the author of Boy Erased. He's talking to us actually from Wisconsin. He's going to be in Chicago this weekend at Printers Row Lit Fest on Sunday. And Garrett, I think everyone has to really read the book if they want to understand sort of the details of what you went through in those couple of weeks you were in this ex-gay therapy program. But can you just share for us at what point, the kind of things they asked you to do, and at what point you realized, and at a certain point you realized this just doesn't make any sense. But in the beginning, can you sort of share a little bit about what they asked you to do?
Definitely. Love in Action was a 12-step program that was modeled off of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it operated under the assumption that all aspects of the spectrum were somehow sinful and also addicting. And each step of the program was designed to lead you into a more shameful, a deeper feeling of shame, so that by the end of the program, you would be willing to do almost anything to exit the quote-unquote lifestyle you were living. And Love and Action placed a lot of different people together. They placed people who were dealing with pedophilia, people who were dealing with bestiality, anyone on the spectrum, so bisexual, gay, lesbian, transgender, all of it was equated as one sin of addiction. And so that was a really confusing start to the program, to be placed into a group with so many people who were dealing with so many different issues. And we would have morning rap sessions, which were another borrowing from Alcoholics Anonymous, where we would share these things called moral inventories. And a moral inventory was an account of some sinful thought or action you had somehow committed. And we had to share those ideas with the people in the group, and then the group would provide Bible verses that were meant to help us out of our situation or our sinful thoughts. So that was one activity. Another activity that we did was a borrowing from some therapeutic practices called the genogram. And a genogram is a family tree where you list all the family members that you have. Only in this version of the genogram, you write down all of the quote-unquote sin symbols in your family. So we would have to write, a D next to someone if they'd ever done drugs, or an AB if anyone had ever had an abortion. And this was supposed to represent the Bible verse that says that the sins of the fathers basically go to the sons, and the generational sin idea. And so on my poster, I had to put like an H next to my name for homosexuality, and I was supposed to look at the poster and think, okay, this is why I've been brought to this point, because there's so much sinfulness in my family. It was almost inevitable that I would end up at a place like Love in Action. And finally, one of the activities that also brought me to a realization about the complexity of our family story was called the lie chair. And I was asked to sit across from an empty chair and imagine my father inside of that chair. This was in front of the entire group. And the counselor said, you need to share all of your anger that you have towards your father with the group. And I looked at them and I said, I'm not actually angry, I'm actually sad. And the counselors kept telling me that I was not experiencing legitimate feelings, and that I was mad and I was just trying to hide it, and that I'd been trying to hide so many things since the moment I walked in their doors. And that was the moment when I actually walked out. I was so angry, and I called my mother and she came to pick me up.
And that's the moment where you do literally just walk out, and you walk out the door, and before they had sort of, they take your phone before you go in, and it's kind of this, it's such a bizarre thing as I was reading it, because I realize you're in this program for a couple of weeks, you're staying in a hotel with your mom, so at the end of the day you go home and you're in the hotel, well, you go back to the hotel with your mom. And then you also, then you're also, this is in the middle of your college. Like this is in the middle of while you're in college, you have taken time off to go do this. And so, what do you remember most about when you just walked out of that room? What do you think it was that finally just got you to say, because it really does seem it's that moment where you just are like, okay, I'm done. And then you just walk out. And then it's so interesting to me that they just also let you walk out and your mom does come and get you, and that is the end of it.
Well, there were a few things that I didn't include in the book that occurred during that moment. So whenever I walked out, I asked for my phone back and I called my mom, and without hesitating, she came to pick me up. But the minute that I got into the car, one of the counselors, Danny Cosby in the book, came outside and he told my mother that I needed much more therapy, that I needed to stay for maybe, a year, drop out of college, maybe 2 years. And my mother said to him, "What are you even qualified to do here? What is your degree?" And he said, "Well, ma'am, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm also a marriage counselor." And my mom, in one of her nastier moments, but I think it was very deserved, she said, "What is an alcoholic doing treating my son?" And he said, "Well, it's all the same." And my mom, who had not asked a lot of questions thus far, said, "This is ridiculous." And then when we were in the car, we didn't know what we were going to do. We were driving back, and we didn't want to go home because my dad was waiting to know if everything had been cured or if we needed more time. And my mom said to me, "Are you going to kill yourself?" And I said, "Yes." And in that moment, I don't exactly know if I believed that I was going to kill myself. I certainly was having suicidal ideation, but I did know that this was the answer that would get me home, and I was ready to go home.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Garrett Conley about his memoir. It's called Boy Erased, about his time in an ex-gay therapy program. Garrett, thanks for being with us. Stick around, everyone. We'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Garrett Conley. He's an author and writer. His memoir is called Boy Erased. It's about his time in an ex-gay therapy group. And he's actually in town. He's in Chicago this weekend. He's taking part in Printer's Row Lit Fest. He's joining us right now from Wisconsin as he's on his book tour. Garrett, I know you've been touring around, and there's a quote that someone tweeted that you had at a book reading, that it doesn't take being in ex-gay therapy to be in ex-gay therapy. It's all around us. I wonder if you could explain a little bit more by what you meant by that.
Yes. In my book, the way I structured it, I wanted to show how the kinds of poison that existed in ex-gay therapy were already existent in many of the life experiences I already had. My dad and his dealership, that, you know, he was a car dealer before he became a preacher. There was this really intense cult of masculinity that was going on at that time. And I think in many ways that was picked up by Love and Action. What I always say to people is that Love and Action acted sort of as a microcosm for all of the bigotry that I'd already experienced my whole life, and especially in the church. And many of these ex-gay counselors have now come out as gay and live with their partners. And so I believe that a lot of what went on at Love and Action was just internalized bigotry from their childhoods, and in many ways childhoods that were more difficult than mine, just by being at an earlier time. And so I believe that many of these people, they were told, okay, don't act this way, don't be a sissy, don't stand that way, don't use your voice that way. And that was painful for those people. And I believe that they felt that they were sort of saving a younger generation from that kind of pain. If they could tell us the cheat codes for how to be more masculine or how to be less gay.
Yeah.
And I believe that I think they thought they were doing us a favor.
Have you heard from other people who have gone through this since you've written this? I imagine you probably heard from people all over the country, or maybe all over the world.
Yeah, I've been hearing from people who submit to my website stories that are heart-wrenching and in many ways triumphant. So most of these people are still dealing with the after effects of ex-gay therapy. You know, I still wake up sometimes with a feeling of shame because of some of the things I've been taught. But it's been great to connect with these people because we're all on this journey together. You know, we call ourselves survivors of ex-gay therapy. And this one kid in Kentucky sent me this email about how he'd never heard a story like this before, and that it just helped him affirm the fact that he wasn't crazy. Because when you grow up in what I would consider in many ways to be a cult, it's hard to move on past that, and it's hard for people to understand you. And sometimes you feel like you're always explaining yourself to people, and that the more you explain yourself to people, the wider their eyes get and the more they want to say, I'm sorry, but it's not a real connection. So when you meet somebody who's actually survived it and has sort of that dark gothic humor of surviving it, it feels like you're with a new family. So I've loved that experience.
Geared, you wrote that your parents didn't want you to write the memoir and they were worried about your father losing his job. Did that happen?
He hasn't lost it yet. There was a man who stood up during an election to decide whether or not people should invite him to come to a revival. Because my dad goes around and speaks at revivals sometimes. And a man stood up and he said, you know, this man's son is openly gay and he's writing this book. And they voted against my dad to come. And so this has been happening. And some members of my dad's church have been following me on Twitter and, like, reporting back to people in the church about what I'm saying. And so there is a bit of I wouldn't call it chaos in the church, but it's certainly a trying time, I think, there. But my dad actually stood up in front of everyone on a Wednesday night service and said, I know everyone's talking about my son, and I understand that. But if you need to leave, you can. I'm going to be here. And so even though my dad doesn't quite agree with my views, he is tired of people talking about me, I think.
Well, and the last line of this book is you thanking your parents. And you say that their love has made all the difference for you. And you also write about how much your mother has apologized to you repeatedly to you for her role in having you attend the ex-gay therapy program. So it sounds like you're still maintaining a relationship with your parents.
I am. And my mother actually went to the reading in Brooklyn, and it was amazing. Everyone loved her. She's just like I describe her in the book. She asked me before she went to the Brooklyn reading, should I wear the lace or the ruffles? And I said, both.
Well, now, unlike when you were a kid, you're probably not embarrassed that your mom is like the flashiest, like most fashionable person in town, right?
Oh, it's gotten me a lot of like every gay guy on Twitter is like, can I be friends with your mom? It's been very helpful in that way. She actually asked me to take a picture of her clutch purse so that everyone could see the detail on it because they would miss it during the reading. But my dad, he's been pretty supportive. He called right before that reading and said that he was happy that I'd done what I wanted to do. It still remains complicated, and I'm sure that in many ways, if they're truthful with themselves, they wouldn't have wanted me to have published this book. But I also think the airing of secrets can be very helpful for a Southern family that's pretty tight-lipped. I think in the end it's going to be something that will help us overall.
That book is Boy Erased. The author who we've been speaking to this hour on the 21st is Gerard Conley. Again, he's on Sunday in Chicago around 12:15 speaking at Printers Row Lit Fest about this memoir, Boy Erased. Gerard, thanks for being with us on the 21st.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is the 21st. Talk to any farmer around Illinois, and one of the first things you'll likely hear is how great the dirt is here. I know a lot of farmers have told me that. So it's counterintuitive that Illinois uses more fertilizer per acre than most states. We're second only to Iowa. That's because, of course, science tells us the healthier a soil is, the less fertilizer it needs. With the rising cost of fertilizer and the growing awareness of its environmental impact, there's been a push for farmers to fine-tune the way they apply fertilizer. We're going to be talking to scientists and entrepreneurs who are working on this, and we wanted to start with soil scientist Richard Mulvaney, who's in studio with me now. He's an environmental sciences professor at the University of Illinois. Richard, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla. It's good to be here.
Could you give us some history on nitrogen fertilizer and how it's been used in the past?
I sure can. Nitrogen fertilizers go back almost 100 years, actually more. But they didn't really become mainstream products until the 1960s. And at that point, there was a shift in the output of those fertilizers. Actually, what had happened is that the fertilizers came from an industry that had been making war munitions. And with the end of World War II, the output was redirected toward producing fertilizers. It took a while for those to get into the mainstream market, but they did. And by the 60s, that change was well along, and farmers were using a lot more nitrogen fertilizer than they ever had before. And not just that, but the farming practices were undergoing a profound change because now farmers could buy their nitrogen instead of growing it with legumes.
So then that kind of, it sort of became, well, and I imagine, Richard, you're saying this also kind of went along with a lot of the changes we saw with farming in the past couple of decades becoming bigger, and the sort of the trend to having more large-scale farming as well. All of that kind of goes along with this.
That's exactly right. But the point I would make there is that nitrogen fertilizers were one of the cornerstones to bring in this industrialized system of agriculture.
And there's guidelines. There's a University of Illinois agronomy handbook that has sort of guidelines for fertilizer application. How have those changed over the years?
Well, going back into the 1970s, a system was put in place that was essentially a yield-based recommendation. It called for nitrogen rates to be directed toward expected yield for corn, and the factor of 1.2 became well known as the key for estimating a nitrogen rate. That system was widely used and still is, but in the 2000s, I think it was actually 2009, the Agronomy Handbook in its most recent edition came out with a new system, which was called maximum return to nitrogen, and it went away from that 1.2 factor and kind of gave a generic prescription based on a collection of nitrogen response data from previous trials.
And there is a rate calculator online now, and I want to get to that in a second, but for people who are listening, I know in the past on the 21st, we've talked about environmental problems that fertilizer causes. For example, we've talked about towns like Decatur and Des Moines having to take nitrate out of the water. What other environmental problems does fertilizer cause if it's then gets into other things, obviously, outside of farmland?
Well, Nyla, you're right. The best known problems connected with nitrogen show up in water. We're all aware of nitrate pollution. But that is by no means the only consequence. There are also issues for air quality. When nitrogen is lost, some of it can be lost to the air in the form of nitrous oxide. That is a greenhouse gas. And then there's another problem that my colleagues and I came to grips with some 8 or 10 years ago, and that is that nitrogen fertilizers actually have an effect on the soil itself. And what I mean by that is that the nitrogen applied as fertilizer isn't just used by the crop. It's also taken up by soil microorganisms, and it promotes their activities to consume organic matter.
And when you say soil microorganisms, do you mean worms or what else?
No, I'm talking about things on the order of bacteria, fungi, and that type of thing.
Really, microorganisms.
Microorganisms.
Okay. That's Richard Mulvaney. He's an environmental sciences professor at the University of Illinois. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Kastub Belarau is the CEO of Soil Diagnostics Incorporated. Kastub, can you tell us a little bit about your company and what you all are doing to help farmers with this issue?
Certainly, and thank you, Nyla. Pleasure to be on the show. I'm actually an associate professor in the Ag and Biological Engineering Department, and we, over the last couple of years, we've been developing technologies to speed up the soil tests that are most valuable and most actionable from a farmer's perspective. And so one of the tests we developed was a nematode test for soybean cyst nematodes, and that got some interest. We got some money to go prototype it, and the university actually gave us some funds to go and explore commercialization options. And while we were in the midst of that, Dr. Mulvaney and Dr. Khan and myself, we had a meeting, and we realized that we could help them commercialize one of their tests that they had been working on for a long time, which is the Illinois soil nitrogen test.
And these tests, how widespread are they right now? How widespread are tests for farmers to test? And what you're essentially testing is the nutrient capacity within the soil to know how much fertilizer is needed, correct?
That's correct. So the recommendations were based on the demand side of the plant, so how much the plant's going to pull up in its lifetime. But there's also a supply side, how much the soil can provide over the growing season. And this test is actually a measure of that supply capacity. And there's other factors that go into it, but it's a chemical test, and we expect about 500,000 to 1 million acres currently benefit from this test right now. It's hard to gather that data, but it's always been a fairly slow test to run. It was never designed to be a test that every farmer can access. It was rather a lab test for research purposes only that some intrepid soil agronomists took on and tried to commercialize by themselves. And they're the ones actually who came to us and said, we can't keep up.
In a few minutes, we're going to hear more about that test and how that test works. But is it also different, Kastub? Is it, I imagine you also need to know, depending on what kind of crop you're trying to grow, you need to also have there, I imagine there's specific calculations depending on what you're trying to grow to know what nutrients you need?
That is correct. Again, the crop has a certain demand and the soil has a certain supply. And the best way is to match the supply for the demand at that growing time for that crop under those weather conditions. And this is fairly complex. You need to know about the weather, the soil, how much is going to become available, what's excess, what's going to run off. And so all of these calculations have to be made before you can pinpoint with any reasonable accuracy the amount of nitrogen that you need.
Richard, how have farmers in the past done this? Because obviously there's lots of calculations that go into these things. How has this been done previously?
Well, as I mentioned previously, this 1.2 system came into widespread use. And so it was a simple matter for farmers and fertilizer dealers to estimate how much nitrogen should be applied just by multiplying an expected yield goal times 1.2.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking about fertilizer and nitrogen, and we're going to pick up this conversation in just a minute. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. We've been talking about nitrogen fertilizer in the soil in Illinois. We've been talking about how difficult it is for farmers to scientifically know how much nutrients are in their soil and therefore how much fertilizer to use. Earlier, one of our production assistants, Austin Keating, went to Farmer City to a lab that tests soil. Some of the things we've been talking about with our guest, Kastub Belarau. He started Soil Diagnostics Incorporated to make that test better. He'll be going to market with that next month. They were in the process of doing the Illinois soil nitrogen trait test when Austin went by, and he spoke to Tim Smith. He's the owner of CropSmith, Inc. He serves about 100,000 acres of farmland in central Illinois. His goal is to let farmers know how much nitrogen, a key fertilizer, is in their soil. And Tim starts in a room that's very hot. Think very dry sauna.
So in the drying room, we blow air down through the samples. The drying room's about 116 degrees right now. And that heat and the blowing the dry air through them will just drive the moisture off of the sample and dry them out. Usually, you know, 24 to 48 hours is how long it takes to from when we get a sample in to have it dry to where we're ready to grind it. Grinds it to a nice kind of fine powder, and then we sieve it through a 100 mesh screen. We'll weigh out 1 gram of soil, and then we add sodium hydroxide. The sodium hydroxide has a really high pH, and it breaks down the bonds in the organic matter in the soil. And then we seal it all up, and we put it on the hot plate for 5 hours. Right now, it's a nice bright red. As it starts absorbing nitrogen, it'll turn kind of a green or blue color because there's indicator solutions in there that will change color as the pH rises. We do a lot of things by hand, and I think he's going to automate some of these steps. Our hope is that we can maybe do 10 times as much as we're doing now. And if we can do 10 times as much in a day as we're doing now, then we can offer the test to more farmers and for less money than what we're charging now.
Thanks to Austin Keating for producing that for us. That technique you just heard was developed by Richard Mulvaney, who's in studio with us, as well as it's that technique has been improved upon by Soil Diagnostics Incorporated. Kastub Bellarau is in studio with us as well. He's the CEO of that. Kastub, can you explain for us, there's a part where Tim says the dirt has to be on a hot plate for 5 hours. The problem you guys are trying to solve here is figuring out the nutrients that it's already in soil. And that seems like, to someone like me, it seems, why couldn't you just do a test and figure that out? This seems like a much more complex process.
It is. The sodium hydroxide that's added to the soil requires a certain amount of time and temperature to get that reaction to proceed. And that reaction is slow. You can speed it up with heat, or you can let it sit for a little bit longer and have it proceed at room temperature. So one of the improvements we're doing is actually we no longer need the hot plates. So that's a big capital savings for any soil tester who wishes to do this. These are all going to be room temperature tests. We've changed the chemistry somewhat to accommodate that difference in temperatures. And moreover, we've added a lot of smarts to the system. So currently, the method of tracking a soil sample through your lab, you need to know where it was pulled from, which farm it belongs to, and so on. That's all Sharpie on a paper bag, and that's going to change substantially. So we're putting RFID tracking, which is the kind of stuff you see at the checkout line.
Right. So you're automating all of this and using all of that technology. Imagine that's all being aggregated, so it's a lot easier to keep track of these results as well.
Correct. And the second big thing that Tim didn't mention is that after that sample has cooked for 5 hours, it has to sit on a specialized machine, an automatic titrator, that takes 2 minutes or 3 minutes per sample to actually quantify how much nitrogen is in that sample. And that's gone. So now we have a very rapid, you just put that sample in our hood, close the hood, and you have an instant result. So that 3 minutes per sample limits that throughput to about 150 per day per person.
And how important do you think this information should be for farmers? Because I think ultimately, would this end up saving them a lot of money in the long run in terms of how much they're spending on fertilizer, Richard?
It sure could, especially for the farmers who are farming better and more productive soils. Those are the soils with higher nutrient supplying capacities, and they have less need for fertilizer. This test that we're talking about can help farmers scale back on their nitrogen fertilizer usage.
Well, in a way, it almost sounds like, would you describe this as you're also being able to analyze and therefore unlock the strength of the soil that farmers are already working with? Kastub, is that an accurate way to describe it?
It is actually a quantitative measure of the fertility of the soil itself.
I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well, an agronomist who's joining us from Northwest Indiana. Dan Towery is with Ag Conservation Solutions. He's involved in an education campaign to teach farmers about the different ways, as we've just been talking about, to tap into the strength of the soil and use less fertilizer. Hey, Dan, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
You've used Tim Smith's lab. We were just hearing about it to test soil before. What do you take away from that experience? What do you tell farmers about how it works?
Well, we use a number of different soil tests, and because basically what we're trying to do is find out what's happening with the soil biology. We've done a great job on the physical and chemical properties, but the biological are kind of the missing link. Unfortunately, the biological is very challenging, though, because you have differences in moisture content, temperature. It's a dynamic system, so it's always changing. So we're using some of what Tim is doing with the ISNT test in conjunction with the Cornell Soil Health test. There's also one called Solvita or the Haney test, and I'm involved in a project that we're collecting all of this information and trying to sort through it and trying to make heads or tails of it. Consistency is the one thing that we seem to not quite understand why we get different results mm-hmm. at different times. So it's definitely a work in progress, I guess, but.
And Kastub, is that what you would say? Yeah, thanks for that. Kastub, is that where the science, you need to be running these tests a little bit more also to kind of figure out the accuracy of everything?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Dan.
No, I was just going to say, it was when do you take it? What happens if you, in fact, I just sent some samples to Tim. We took them this Monday. Well, Saturday they had a 2-inch rain. How is that going to affect the accuracy? We're not sure, but it'll be this one along with other on, and these are on farm trials that we're doing this. So, once we collect enough of them, we still won't have a definitive answer, but hopefully we'll be able to interpret them much better.
Kastub, you're going to market with this next month. I imagine you're looking for farmers to do trials with this, are you?
We're actually looking for agronomists to pick up this test okay. and then have the agronomists help the farmers.
I see. So that's how it works. Agronomists like Dan. Dan, and Kastub, how much do these tests cost?
We have not come up with definitive numbers yet.
Okay.
Okay. Because we're going to be working with the agronomists. I think there's many different things to consider. One is this is a seasonal business, so soil sampling happens in a very short amount of time. And we have to figure out what our revenue structure is going to look like in order to keep us going. So there's a number of different issues associated with it. What we do have, what we can say right now is that there is an upfront cost to buying some of the equipment. But because we've set up our system so that it runs all over the web, it's a full. If you can do email, you can run our test. The system is so simple, and it'll actually bill you every single time you do the test. And so what we hope that's going to be helpful to the agronomists is so they don't have to worry about a cash flow situation themselves. So they're not paying for the test year long; they're paying for whenever they do it. So it's kind of a pay as you go model we're thinking of.
Dan, what time of year do farmers typically do soil tests?
Well, it used to be in the fall. Now they're doing it more in the spring. But let me just add on to that. I mean, one of the huge questions out there, there's a huge amount of spatial differences across the field. And so, how many samples do you need? Can a lot of farmers with using precision farming have developed management zones? How does that relate to doing tests like this? It should fit fairly well, but again, we're still learning on exactly how that interaction is going to take place.
Richard, of course, all of this, we've been talking about this from the farming perspective and how this helps farmers and produces more efficient crops. It's also obviously cheaper to use less fertilizer. And we just began to touch on before the break about the environmental impacts of this. I mean, what's your hope for, I wonder, as you sort of look at, as we're seeing increasing amounts of nitrate in our water and that runoff, and we're seeing sort of how that's even going down the Mississippi River and affecting the Gulf of Mexico. What's your hope with what we can see long term with this for mitigating environmental damage?
Well, I'm very hopeful that this strategy of soil in testing can have a positive benefit for reducing those environmental problems. And there's good reason to think that. It could take a bit of time to begin to see those benefits develop. But if we're able to scale back the fertilizer inputs and avoid excessive inputs that could potentially exacerbate those environmental problems, it stands to reason that we should help reduce those pollution problems.
Dan, do you feel like there's enough? Do you feel like there's enough scientists and soil scientists and folks like Richard and Kostub doing work on this, or would you like to see even more people working on this issue?
Well, that's somewhat of a loaded question. You know, we've got two different models taking place here. The projects I'm involved with are using a lot of cover crops, no-till. So we're not doing tillage, so we're not oxidizing that active organic matter fraction, which is potentially down the road can lead to some of this nitrogen being available through the soil biology. So we can keep going with the intensive tillage and continue with the 1.2 pounds, or we can look at a more environmentally friendly, using cover crops, no-till, strip-till, using the soil to help us manufacture nitrogen. And so we need less. The timing is also important. There are just a number of things that go into it. All I know is I'm working with growers that are using 0.7, 0.8 pounds of nitrogen and still producing same yields, if not better, than when they were using 1.2.
Wow. Okay. Well, thanks so much for all of you for sharing a little bit more about this issue. Dan Towery is an agronomist with Ag Conservation Solutions. Kostub Bellarau and Richard Mulvaney both teach at the University of Illinois. Kostub in agricultural engineering, Richard in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Nyla. It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you, Nyla.